Hello, everyone, and welcome to a documentary podcast. We're back, 2024. This is the year. I'm your co-host, Joshua Labior.
And I'm Catherine Sullivan.
And we are two filmmakers and cinephiles who talk about nonfiction cinema like their movies.
Yes. Well, they still are films. I think a lot of them, still can follow similar themes and structure. So, yeah.
Exactly. And that's like kind of the whole point of the podcast. If it's your first time listening, or if you haven't, you know, if you've forgotten because we haven't recorded an episode in a while, that's kind of the idea of the podcast, is that we both love documentaries as its own kind of cinematic art form. And we like to highlight the films that we love that we're watching and sometimes talk about ones that we don't love so much. And so today we're kind of catching up. We haven't recorded an episode in a while. We've both seen lots of movies. I have been programming a documentary series through my radio show, doing lots of interviews through my radio show as well, making films and going to film festivals.
I've been so a little bit of on a work hiatus, but went down to Sundance Film Festival, primarily to see Suncoast, a film I worked on like a little over a year ago, and then also used it as an excuse to like watch a ton of films and definitely prioritize watching documentaries, since I think, as I've mentioned on episodes before, I really prefer seeing films in theaters and it's harder to see documentaries in theaters. So did as much of that as I could.
Nice. Yeah. I've been, I have my new documentary coming out next month. It's called The Instrument in Six Movements. We're doing a premiere at the Benson Theater in Omaha, and just been working on that. I've been filming a couple other things, and then like I said, I just started this documentary series, and so some of the films that I'll be talking about are ones that we're showing in the series, so I'm excited about that. And then you're going to cover, I only saw one film at Sundance, so we're going to cover that one together, which is Union, the new film from Brett Story, who directed The Prison and 12 Landscapes and The Hottest August. So with that, maybe let's just start with you with, you know, what are some of the highlights of Sundance for you?
Just overall, I think Sundance narrative and documentary films, I was very impressed with. And just in general, I think the films of last year, and I was like going down like a thinking, just thinking a lot about movies. And I think a lot of like the films have been so strong, especially these documentaries, is because they've been like such simple, universal feelings of just like love, loss, connection. And I think that all came out of almost like COVID in a way of like, sometimes like the simplest of feelings are the strongest, and we experience these things in such powerful ways that I feel like a lot of filmmakers are relying on that instead of like overcomplicating other parts of stories. But yeah, I just wanted to add that in because I was thinking about that a lot last night. But probably it's a tie for two of my favorites, but I think my favorite was A New Kind of Wilderness. It's a documentary from Norway. The director, I don't know how to pronounce her name. I'm going to say like Silje Evanesmo Jacobsen. But it follows a family who's living kind of an isolated farm in Norway, and sadly their mother passes away, and it's about the father, who's actually British, trying to find a way to raise his kids in a more now challenging landscape with like not having as much money, so they can't necessarily afford the home they live in anymore, and just being a single parent and what comes with that. And so it's really interesting to watch it unfold of like he had this plan with his wife of how they wanted to raise their children, you know, homeschool in nature on a farm, but that no longer was feasible. So him trying to learn this balance of do they go to school, you know, how can I still work, but also maintaining the sort of the life that he and his wife had envisioned. And it was just done, at first it gave like very much like Captain Fantastic vibes, but in a really authentic way. But it was just so simple, and they just kind of followed the family and how each kid and the father experienced loss differently and how they were coping and how they still stayed together. And there's definitely, I did appreciate a lot of the critique on like technology and us not being as connected to nature, and that's what really heals. But it still wasn't like too much, you know, like you need to live this type of lifestyle. Yeah, I don't know. I really loved it. Haven't experienced anything like they did, but it was just, I don't know, a film that really makes you connect to it. Despite, I don't think there was no score, no fancy camera work, just following this family. And then the other thing that stood out about this one was sort of the sense of time, and that I think it follows them for maybe like 3-4 years after the mother dies, but you'd never really know when it is, more of just based off birthdays and seasons. And I think that sort of echoed how when you're experiencing loss or just as life as a kid, time doesn't always feel the same. Like there's moments that are heavier and more impactful, and then ones that just blow by. And I think the film did a really good job of being like, time is not such a linear thing, that certain like moments or parts of life are more impactful, and she would kind of focus on certain times more than others. But you didn't really realize that till the end when you're like, wait, how old is everybody? When is it? But I liked that a lot.
If you want to, I just looked it up and it's pronounced Silje Wensmo Jacobsen.
Okay, I think I got the last name right, maybe.
Yeah. It looks like a gorgeous film. I can't wait to see it. And I think it's like pretty telling that a lot of these types of films, it's just kind of giving me vibes just because of where it's filmed in Scandinavia and just kind of like the nature aspect to one of our favorite films from last year, which was also your favorite film at Sundance, which was The Smoke's on a Sisterhood, which was actually the last episode that we posted. So.
What's interesting is I went into this film expecting that, or that sort of cinematography. It wasn't there, and I actually wasn't disappointed. Like, it wasn't like Norway? Yeah, the fjords or the big mountains of Norway. It was, I think, a bit more rural and it was pretty, but most of it was actually like filmed in their home. So like I feel like you could feel the nature that they were living in these places, but you actually didn't see it as much. It was more from, I think, how the family interacted and how the kids were, which I think worked really well. But I would be the person who would be upset, I feel like, by not having more mountain shots. But it's weird, even from like the photo you see, like, and I think a lot of the press, it makes it seem like it's a bunch of landscape cinematography, but there really wasn't any.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. One of the ones I'm going to highlight is one I saw on the Criterion Channel recently, and it's an older film. It's from 1967. It's about an hour long. It's directed by Bill Jersey and Barbara Connell. And actually, it's really interesting because it follows a pastor or a priest at a Augustana Lutheran church here in Omaha, Nebraska, in the 1960s, as the all white essentially church, the pastor wants to reach out to kind of the black church kind of in North Omaha. And it's a really honest film. It's a Verite style film. It feels very much in the realm of the Maisel brothers and the Drew Associates, like that kind of film. You know, and it really shows kind of the attitudes at the time. And it's incredibly frustrating and it's sad to look at. And also, being from Omaha, I think it's an interesting document of that time in our city. And it features someone who in Omaha is a big part of the community still to this day in the political realm. And this shows him when he is a young guy working in a barbershop, and his name's Ernie Chambers. So even if you're not from Omaha, I think there's a lot to take from this film and getting like a view of like what the Midwest was like in the late 60s. And as far as like race relations and the systemic racism in these like quote unquote Midwest nice communities. And I just also thought it was just a beautiful, patient, verite film that is just really well done, and a type of film that might, you know, not be possible to kind of recreate these days. So I like watching a lot of these old films because people, I don't think that they really, I think people had in some ways their guards down a lot more and were just, they weren't sure what was going to happen with these films or if anyone would see them or whatever. And there's some like brutally honest stuff in here that's caught.
Where did you say this one was available to watch again?
I saw it on the Criterion channel.
Criterion channel. Okay.
Yeah. I think that you can like find it on YouTube and stuff, but the one on the Criterion channel is high quality and nice. So I would definitely suggest watching it on there.
Okay. So I would say my second film, documentary I saw at Sundance was called Every Little Thing. Originally I'd like, when I was scrolling through the program, like just passed by this because it's a documentary about a woman who saves hummingbirds in LA. And I was like, it kind of came across like it could have been like, you know, your first student film documentary project where you're told to like profile someone interesting. And it's funny, even though it has that structure, it like by far exceeded my expectations and like was definitely one of my favorites I saw. So it's directed by Sally Aitken. And I guess the brief synopsis is, you know, amongst LA, a woman finds herself on a transformative journey as she nurtures wounded hummingbirds, and follows, a magical tale of love, fragility, healing, and the delicate beauty and tiny acts of greatness. And I think that's like a great description. It's similar, I guess, to the other film. It's just all these little moments of you just see someone caring and love, and it's like they're just little hummingbirds, like why should I care? But I guess we all, in like kind of like a sentimental way, like we all need to be cared for, like we all go through hard times, and just these little hummingbirds, it's something in life we overlook. And just to see how this woman has dedicated her life to this, it was just like so heartfelt and so heartwarming. It reminded almost like Biggest Little Farm, sort of like happiness vibes, but she like authentically lives this way. It is really interesting because during the film, you don't get to know her background really. It's kind of like sprinkled about. And because at first you're like, why is she living in this massive mansion in the hills of, I don't know LA very well, but like, somewhere in the hills of Hollywood, like, what is this? And or also, like, I appreciated the little bits about her history to sort of know where she came from, but in the end, you realize, like, it isn't the most important thing. And I do really like how she's, like, a very sort of tough, no-nonsense woman, which I think adds, like, a cool contrast to these little hummingbirds. And then the last point, too, is I really, as someone who's never been, like, as much as I love cameras, like, a geek on camera development or needing the nicest camera, like, I will say the advancements in cameras to capture these hummingbirds was, like, unreal. Like, this was the first time I think I saw it put to use, that I was like, okay, they needed fast frame rates or whatever they did. Because, like, at first when I was watching, I thought the hummingbirds were, like, fake. But no, it's just what cameras can do these days. So
I think the next one I'm going to highlight is this one's from 2021. And I feel like it was kind of slept on. I hadn't heard a lot of people talk about it. And it's called Taming the Garden. Hang on one second. Let's see. So it's directed by Salome Jashi, and it's a Georgian film. So it's Georgia's former prime minister has a huge, weird, unique hobby of collecting really old trees, some that are like insanely tall 15-story building trees, and he gathers them from neighborhoods across the country to bring to his private garden. And the film really doesn't set you up with much information. And it's really what I love about it is it's a quiet film that you kind of start to pick up the thesis and the idea of the film and what's happening just through the imagery. It's a lot of like long kind of quiet takes. It's a lot of like showing you landscapes, showing the process of how they move these trees. It's almost kind of surreal. It's a little bit meditative. It's kind of mesmerizing in a way. And it's kind of utterly infuriating as well. So it's a really beautiful film. It's a political film, and it's just kind of one of those movies that just kind of, it's like the reason why I love nonfiction is when you can make a film like this and say so much without actually like using a bunch of you know, dialogue. The film is a really, I think it's kind of a masterpiece. So I'd like to see people talking about it more, which is why I wanted to highlight it here today. And that one's playing on Mubi right now. So
I will say I looked it up. I've seen this film. But I don't, this is terrible. Like I don't, it hasn't stuck with me, but look, I remember the visuals now seeing the tree are stunning.
Yeah. I don't know what it was. It could,
but yeah, I would,
it could be one if you're not in the right mood. It could just like kind of feel, I think if you connect with it, I think those images will linger with me for a long time.
Yes. It felt, what I'm remembering, like very hypnotic, just sort of like you get in the place. It must, but I think 3 years later. But yeah, that is good. Like looking back at it, just seeing the photo of the tree on just like Google Images, I'm like, oh yes, I remember that. I remember the feeling of that. So
yeah, and I've been kind of into the,
I guess it does
I've been kind of getting back into kind of collecting, not just for collection's sake, but like buying movies on physical media, because streaming is just getting so wild, and we're spending so much on streaming, and every documentaries are so hard to find, and documentary filmmakers, like it's so hard for them to make their money back, that whenever I see one come out on Blu-ray and like a nice edition or something like that, I'll grab it. And actually Vinegar Syndrome on their website has a beautiful Blu-ray version of this film. So I had actually started watching it on Mubi, and I was really loved the first images, but I realized I was too sleepy to watch a movie like that, so I'd save it for another day. And then I saw that Vinegar Syndrome, and it wasn't actually Vinegar Syndrome, they have sub-labels, but one of their sub-labels, and I'm forgetting which one, released this, but if you go to Vinegar Syndrome's website, you'll find it. So I ordered the Blu-ray whenever they were having like a sale and got it in, and the Blu-ray looks gorgeous. I decided to watch it on that, so I would definitely suggest Taming the Garden.
So would I. Okay, so the last film we'll talk about from Sundance that I really liked was called Gaucho Gaucho, and it's directed by, apologize if I don't get these ones correct either, Michael Dwecht and Gregory Kershaw. And so it's about a community of cowboys and cowgirls living in Argentina, and just their lives down there, and just sort of like the Western world of Argentina. And it's probably one of the most beautifully shot films I've seen in so long. I mean, there was just, you could freeze frame so many of just the shots, and it's just like the outfits people are in amongst like the trees and dogs running around on horses in Argentina. Like, it's absolutely beautiful. And so for me, it felt more of just like a visual film to watch. However, so they decided to put it in black and white. And it was really interesting in the Q&A, someone was like, what was the decision behind this? This is where I'm gonna get a bit of critical, is they said, well, we just looked at it in black and white and we thought it looked cool, so that's what we did. I thought that worked, which I always, maybe is what I learned in school, that was like, if you're gonna do black and white, you have to have a reason. Like there needs to be something motivating. And I think that applied a bit to this film in ways that, like, when it was these long shots or close-ups, like the black and white was incredible, made everything look like a painting or like a photo hanging in a museum. But I think it made it harder to develop the story. And when there was more like people at home or dialogues happening, it felt a bit out of place. Or I still feel like within that culture, there are some really colorful moments that part of me was thinking like, but what colors would this be? What would this look like? So it helped in making the film feel timeless and the scenes that felt timeless, or look like you were looking at a culture from 100 years ago, but that's how people are today. So yeah, I'm conflicted on that, but it's just a visually just stunning film. And like, I think it needs to be seen on the biggest screen you have possible, but that's always hard these days. But yes, highly recommend if you love photography, especially.
You can never go wrong with the film about a photographer. Criterion's is releasing All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which I'm really excited for that release. I think it comes out this month, actually, or next month, on Blu-ray, and probably on, I think it's on Criterion Channel right now. But that's a great one because it kind of mixes like some of the topics we're going to talk about next, which is politics, with the photography and the art. But the last movies I'm going to suggest are kind of tangentially related to the film we're talking about today, and they're both classic documentaries. They're both from the 70s. And one of them is The Wobblies from 1979. It just had a 4K restoration from the Museum of Modern Art, directed by Stuart Bird and Deborah Schaefer. And it goes into the kind of creation of the IWW and kind of the workers' rights movement of the early 1900s, and what led to all of the big labor struggles that were happening, and specifically with the IWW and the creation of that organization. And since it was made in 1979, you know, they have on-camera interviews with like dozens of people who were actually there during the creation of the union. And so it's nice to hear it, you know, from the people who did it, and just kind of the history of that union and union struggle in general, and how they won weekends and the 8-hour workday and stuff like that. And then the other one I want to suggest that also relates to what we're talking about is Harlan County, USA, from Barbara Koppel, from 1977. And it's just about a miner's strike in Harlan County, Kentucky, against the Duke Power Company, and just how intense that union struggle was. Both of these films are directly related to what we're talking about, not only in subject matter that they're about union struggles and workers' rights, but I also think it's interesting that all three of those, including the next film we're going to talk about, which is Union from Brett Story, they're all directed by women, which I think is an important thing as well. And so with that, I think we should get into Union.
I also want to second, I feel like there's been a lot of incredible woman-made films this and last year. And it's, I think, especially great they're not always being marketed as women-made films, which I think is even better. So, yeah.
We're going to talk about a film by one of my favorite filmmakers. Her name is Brett Story. And she did a film about the union struggle at an Amazon factory with Chris Smalls in
JFK, outside JFK.
Where was it? Yeah, outside of JFK in New York. And this just played at Sundance. It had its premiere. Brett Story has directed a couple of my favorite films, The Hottest August and The Prison and 12 Landscapes. I would say this has some of the DNA of those films, but it did feel a little different.
Felt very different.
Yeah, so talk about kind of your initial impressions. I know you said you kind of changed your mind on it.
So this was probably when you said Brett Story had a film at Sundance. Because it was weird, when you looked it up, she was the second name, so it didn't pop up. I was, like, so excited to see this. Like, luckily was able to see it at the premiere. And so I think seeing it with an audience, especially an audience who probably champions a lot of these issues, was really powerful. Like, everyone would be like...
Yeah, I guess I should correct myself. It was co-directed by Brett Story and Stephen Meng.
But to hear, like, even I was, like, with my friends, I was, like, talking with them out of frustration at a lot of points. So I think this is, like, especially with the power of Amazon and just massive corporations, like, such an important film to see. And how we knew it, but to see, like, how little power the working class has is just horrible. But the power, like, that these people have to fight Amazon and never give up. And you see, like, the company with some of the most money, the most power, like, it's not spoiling it because it's news, but they end up, like, forming a union and defeating Amazon. And I'm like, I don't know how, like, that's just one of the most, I think, inspiring feats probably any person has done over the last couple of years, or, like, a group coming together to do this. And I do love how, like, within the film, like, they allow the people to tell their own story. Like, that's why I love her films. It's the people's story. Like, this is their cause, what it's like. But I felt this was the first film that towed the line of being a little bit too political. I think everyone should unionize. I hate Amazon. Being back in Seattle, I hate Amazon even more. I hate how they're putting all their money towards Blue Origin, which I think was one of the best first shots I've seen in a film in a while, though. The first shot is a Blue Origin rocket going up into space, and it's, like, the most, like, obvious but beautiful metaphor of, like, here goes Bezos into space, leaving us all behind. It was just, I loved that.
In a giant blue yes. penis, of course.
So as much as I champion these causes and think, and also, like, what these people did separately is incredible and people need to keep fighting or just take note of what they did, this film is sort of now made, I think, for the people who would watch it. And I don't, I mean, there's, you shouldn't make a film that's pro-Amazon at all or show their side, but it felt, like, very motivated in ways. And I think the ways I saw that was that it didn't want to depict any of the unionizers in a bad light. It would start to at times and then kind of, like, reel it back in a way, where there's a woman, part of the union, she ends up leaving the union movement because, as a woman, she's not taken seriously. People talk over her, and when they're starting to form, like, the positions within the union, no one listens to her. She doesn't get a position. It's people who are either louder than her or one's a white man with less experience. And I wish some of that would have been explored more, because I still think that is a really interesting point. And I could understand, like, none of us have formed unions before. We don't know what they're facing. So you don't want to be too critical. But I feel like by not being critical of some of the faults within the group, it I think weakens the story or just the film in a way. And then the second part is when they are having the meeting about, I think it's once they've actually gotten enough votes and have a union, and, like, what are we going to bring to the table, and what do we want to fight for in our new deal? They're, like, all arguing in the room, and then one woman just is like, you need to stop, we have to figure this out. And it doesn't really explore necessarily, like, yeah, once you can have a union, like, who's going to run it? Are the people in the room, do they know what they're doing, and is this leadership going to crumble? And I think that would have been interesting to explore the, like, power dynamics within the group. So I don't know how that could have been done better, but I was just sort of like, I think you can present these people as champions and just accomplishing something that seems impossible and fighting forever and being a community of people always not thought of and left behind, but also being like, you know, maybe there are some, this isn't a perfect ending, you know, or.
I see what you're saying with those things. For me, I feel like the film was what it was, which was kind of the story about the struggle itself. I think that another film should be made, because the other films that I talked about, which were Harlem County, USA, and The same can be said for the Wobblies film. You know, a lot of, and this film as well, are all about the struggle itself and the fighting for the union. But I do think that there's so much room for someone to make a different film about how to actually have the contract negotiations and that whole process. I could totally see like a Wiseman-esque, you know, film being made about how unions go through contract negotiations and how they function once they're started. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a necessary film that needs to be made. I don't fault this film for that not being the film, because I feel like that's a whole... That's a whole different project, in my opinion.
I may disagree, because I think mine was... I agree with the latter part of, like, the negotiations could be, it should be a separate film, but also Amazon won't come to the table, so I don't know if that could ever be made. But it was more of in the film. Like, I still can remember the image of the woman sitting in her car, and you can just see the disappointment on her face, where she feels like this group has left her behind and it's not what it used to be. So it's more those moments within it, like, what is this dynamic? And I could see even the negotiation, but I feel like these little parts were put in just to kind of give you this feeling, and I just wish, or these ideas, and I wish they'd either maybe not been included to make it about the union, like as you were saying, or just what this process is, or fill in a bit of more of that, like the woman's perspective, you know, or people who feel like they can't speak out because that the guy in charge is really loud, like just some of the like group dynamics. So I feel like that was where maybe it faulted. Like, I still love this film, think people need to see it, but like I wanted that to be explored more, or just cut out.
I could see that. I thought that it was a good balance, because I thought you get the, I really do think you get how unperfect the process is and how unperfect the leadership is. I thought that the blemishes were shown while also maintaining the trajectory as far as like showing it about a struggle that was ultimately won and then kind of not won at the same time, which I think is the story of unionization. That's the story of America, and that's the story of capitalism. You know, it's like every little fight is a big fight when it comes to capital, and they put so many resources into trying to tear groups apart, and I think you see that. But I also think that there's some like beautifully triumphant moments. Like, one of my favorite things about the film is they're literally in an anti-union class, and I am familiar with these because even before Amazon bought Whole Foods, I worked at Whole Foods, and the old owner before Amazon bought it was also kind of a libertarian right winger, and we had to go to those anti-union classes when union struggles were trying to happen at Whole Foods. So they hired one of those companies to come in, and I remember I was kind of the shit stirrer in those meetings, and it was interesting to see that these people came in, and a few, like especially one specific guy, was like, well, we want to hear what these people have to say. And then after the anti-union, you know, company that got hired to come in to just spread misinformation about unions, you know, they were like, well, we want to hear what they have to say anyway, because we're here. By the end of like the meeting getting kind of hijacked by the people trying to unionize, the guy like totally changed his mind and was mad at these anti-union people for lying. I thought that was like, it was really beautiful to see a lot of these little moments like that happen. I love the imagery that's like outside of the actual Verite stuff that kind of adds to the contextualization of the entire thing. Like you were saying with the rocket at the beginning, and obviously there's kind of this like opening shot that feels very Brett Story-esque with like a ship coming in with like all of these like, you know, containers on it, just like full of crap to deliver to people quickly. And I loved those little moments throughout the film. And I do think that, you know, no film can be everything, but this film really did work for me, and I thought it felt really balanced. And it is a political film, but maybe because I'm okay with that, and I think that some films can be subtle activist films, I feel like I'm okay with that because I don't feel like it was dishonest.
Oh, I agree. I don't think it was dishonest. And I feel like in another country, this wouldn't be a political film. It's just that unions are politicized. But it does, like, despite my critiques, I think I just hold, like, Brett's story to such a, like, high standard. Or maybe it's a good thing, too, like, when a film really makes you think about it. And, like, I've had a lot of discussions about this film. It's interesting to have them in Seattle. But it's because everyone works for the devil here, basically, and tries to justify it. But it's okay. I don't know if we should keep that in. I don't. But don't fully care.
That's fine. Every nonprofit here, even the one that just gave me money, is supported by Warren Buffett, who's anti-union buster.
Yeah, I worked for Miramax, so. But
we're all trying to function in a capitalist
society.
We all
do the best we can. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, we can't all be perfect. But I do love how, though, this is about, the film in the end is about the people who accomplished this, the unionizers, and they did it. And it was incredible hearing, like, them speak after the film, and just, they were proud of the film, which I think is always really important. And then just, sometimes it's helpful, like, to put a face to the person and just, like, how inspiring what these people were able to do. Like, they defeated Amazon. Like, I just, it's incredible. And the way they would, you know, just never gave up in a way, like, as much as that sometimes such a simple premise is of, like, you keep trying, you don't give up, you don't give up. But it's like, these people actually did it. And what that took is just, I don't know, incredible. And I think the film did a really good job of showing that and giving, like, the voice to them.
I'm curious if you... Yeah, and I think this is, I'm not familiar with Stephen Meng, the other director of the film, so I'm not sure how much of their signature is on this film, because I'm not familiar with them. But I'm curious if, like, because I do think, as far as Brett's story goes, this is the least conceptual film, because all of her films are, in my opinion, overtly political. The Prison and 12 Landscapes is, like, clearly about the prison industrial complex. The Hottest August is about climate change, but they're very, like, subtle and more conceptual approaches to it. This is her most direct film, I think, and I'm curious if that maybe is kind of what you're talking about and what you're feeling. Because I did feel that when I was watching the film, because I was kind of going in with the mindset of, I'm going to see something that's, like, conceptual. I didn't watch any trailers.
Were there even trailers? I don't think there was even...
I don't think there were trailers. I didn't read anything about it. I just saw Amazon, Union, Amazon, Bread Story. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I'll watch that. And so I did think I was going in seeing something that was going to be a little more conceptual. And this is the first film I've seen where it follows, like, one group of people of hers. And so I think that there's... I think that that's interesting.
I think...
Just because I wasn't expecting that in some
way. I think,
way.
Yeah, that what you're saying is probably what I was, a short, shortened, condensed version of what I was, I think, explaining. I definitely agree with that. Because, yeah, I went in, because I love just the style and the visual storytelling she does. But I'm curious, like, because of the subject matter and the people they followed, like, would her form, her typical, I guess, format, as you would call it, or style, like, work for this fully? Because, like, sadly, as they show in the film, what is it? They're now making efforts in California to unionize, but I didn't realize each warehouse has to have a separate union. So if you want to unionize, you got to unionize, what, a million people? Like, it's insane. And so I think because of As Now, they were the first ones to unionize. I don't know if there's maybe been one since, that it's not, you couldn't tell, like, an overarching, more subtle story. And you can't be subtle when trying to unionize against Amazon. And they couldn't get into film unless illegally. So maybe this was, like, a, you know, merging of two director styles, but they let the subject matter kind of dictate how it looks in the end, or was told.
Yeah, I think it kind of went from being more of a Wiseman-esque picture of a idea or a organization to being a little more insular, which as far as like Verite films go, if I really think about it in terms of like recent Verite films that I have, this one is still quieter. It's more patient. You know, a lot of the films these days are just so, like, even the Verite films feel quick and, you know, the camera's like erratic and all this stuff. And I'm guilty of that myself as a filmmaker, but this one still felt a little more patient than even most of the Verite films I see these days.
But the most suspenseful of all of her films. It was definitely like, what's going to happen?
I mean, as far as like a lot of the other Brett's Story films, this one definitely feels almost like a thriller. So,
because there's like immediate stakes in this one. The planet, it's a long, long game or sad situation, but this
and
is
I
like.
I feel like I do think that the blending of the two directors, again, I'm not as familiar with the other filmmakers' work. It looks like they did Crime and Punishment, Crime Plus Punishment on YouTube, or not YouTube, on Hulu. And they also directed a film for PBS called High Tech, Low Life. I haven't seen either of those films, so I can't comment on those. I will go watch them now. But I remember people talking about Crime and Punishment. But I haven't seen them. So I'm curious to know, like, just kind of what that collaboration was like, because it does feel so different. But regardless, I thought it was a beautiful film. I loved, you know, no film is perfect, but I really am happy that this film is out, that it's getting out there, and I hope it inspires people to keep up the struggle. And I do think that it's interesting, thinking about how they have to do each factory. Because if you think about a company like Starbucks, another Seattle company, you know, the union struggles there are store by store. And that's like thousands of stores. And Starbucks is shutting down stores that are trying to unionize and then firing everybody. And then...
the Amazon layoff, they don't ever hire them full time, so you can't get enough votes. It's
interesting,
crazy.
You know, because I worked, like I said, I worked at Whole Foods. This was before the buyout. And as much as like Whole Foods was anti-union back then and they were still owned by a right-winger libertarian, you know, when I first got hired at Whole Foods in like 2007 or something, one of the things that one of their markers they were most proud of to show employees is like how low their turnover rate was. But over the years, as they went public, the turnover rate went down and they stopped focusing on that as much. It got higher. I mean, their turnover rate got higher when they went public, which was shortly after I got hired there. And then when Amazon bought it, like now it's like, you know, their turnover rate at Whole Foods is insanely high. And I think that that's part of that is to keep fresh people coming in so people don't aren't able to build relationships with each other and lead to stronger unions. And that's like one of the things that, you know, that's why Uber has been so successful to keep calling their employees freelance contractors or whatever, even though they, you know, have to work a certain amount of hours to keep their stuff up. And they're basically treated like employees and companies like Lyft and all this like gig economy and stuff like that. So we're seeing these techniques and this is kind of a microcosm of that and going against one of the biggest companies. And so it's nice to see that it can happen, even if it's easy.
And the documentary does do a really good job. I think they even talk about it, too, of like Amazon doesn't treat people like people. They're just numbers. They're machines. And like these are the people. And like I loved just and it's really also very outgoing, expressive people with big personalities. And you're like, we're in space and we're not realizing they're humans, you know, and the people aren't replaceable, and these people really show that people are not replaceable. And
and we're also seeing people become political beings like in real time, which is interesting because at the beginning you can kind of tell some of the more intellectual like anarchist types or organizer types you know, with like the academic version of left-wing politics being involved, and they talk to everybody with like certain language and stuff like that that's a little cringy. And then the actual, like, real folks who just work at Amazon. And it's pretty interesting to see how that morphs and how they're able to work together and people learn to be less, like, academic and more realist while also we're watching, you know, normal working people who maybe had never really thought about this stuff become more political. Based on the material circumstances rather than just ideas.
Well, I think that's why they were so successful in the end, is it's like you have to go on what your strengths are and who you are. Like, the most, Amazon has as much money, lawyers, and intellectual, highest educated people. They don't have the people who work there. They don't have that community. They don't know that. So, like, they can't fight that fight. And so I feel like once, yeah, the group started doing that. And it was interesting to see there was a couple phone calls they made with, like, the very, like, white, liberal, New England boarding school type educator. That's a stereotype. But, like, they would get on the phone calls with them and those people would not listen to the unionizers, you know, we should do this way, we should do it this way. And some of them, I think, in the end didn't end up joining. It felt like there was only that one woman, but she was more grassroots, a lot younger, and was just more of like, I'm going to support how I need to be supported and bring in knowledge where it's needed. But I feel like the people who tried to put upon like their education or how things had been done elsewhere, it was a lot of down talking, and then they didn't end up staying. I just loved every time the unionizers would be like, no, we tried that. It doesn't work. It doesn't, like, we actually work 15 hours a day, 16, and have to bus 2 hours one way, bus 2 hours the other way, like, pick up our kids from school. And I think a lot of people, as much as we, you know, I'm definitely probably within the same boat, like, believe in these causes, like, we don't know what that day-to-day life is. And, like, I think it was just nice to see that, like, there isn't necessarily one way to get things done. And I think you need to listen in any circumstance to the people who it's actually affecting the most, or it's because it's their lives and they know it the best. So,
and it's always interesting to see when the ideals come from material conditions and when those merge. I think that that's the interesting dialectic of the film for sure. But I guess that's all I really have to say about it. I mean, it's beautifully shot, great sound design, great music. Like, it's not obtrusive, but there's definitely like some nice ambient music there that I think adds to the vibe of the film. And cinematography is great. I just think it looks beautiful throughout. Yeah, I say watch it. That's my recommendation.
Yes. Like, all these in this episode, was it, now you have to go watch eight films?
I'm actually gonna throw one more in, because I actually started thinking about a Lee Grant documentary from 1981 called The Wilmer Eight, which was about a group of women who try to unionize their bank, and they go on the longest bank strike in American history. And it's a small town that they are, they're all women in a small town. I think, I can't remember where it is, if it's in the Midwest. Yeah, it's in the Midwest. I can't remember exactly what city they were in. But it's interesting because, you know, it's directed by a woman. It's about women going on a strike in a small town and just how they're juggling life between being mothers, employees of, you know, like wives, and just doing that with like getting all of this attention for being on strike in this small town and dealing with, of course, like the systemic sexism and stuff like that, in the workplace and all that. So that's a beautiful documentary too. It was on the Criterion Channel. I think it still might be, but The Wilmer Eight. But I'll put all these in the show notes. So now you have 9 films to watch. I don't remember how we say goodbye, but we can just wing it.
think it's just thanks for listening.
Well, thanks for listening to a newest episode, first episode of 2024 of a documentary podcast. If you want to find out more info, go to documentarypodcast.com.
I think we have an Instagram, a documentary podcast.
And you're all great.
Yes. Thanks for listening.
Unionize your workplace.